From the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, this is Backstory with the American History Guys.
Welcome to the show. I'm Brian Ballow, and I'm here with Peter Oda.
Hey there, Brian.
Ed Ayers is with us.
Hello, Brian.
My fellow Americans, I'm about to sign into law the Civil Rights Act of 1964.
This is President Lyndon B. Johnson, 50 years ago this week. It was clear to everybody who was watching that the legislation Johnson was signing, legislation that eliminated segregation in the South, was nothing short of momentous.
Congress passes the most sweeping civil rights bill ever to be written into the law, and thus reaffirms the conception of equality for all men that began with Lincoln and the Civil War 100 years ago.
Now, it can be tempting to look back at this time as an era when government actually worked, when government actually could achieve great things. But you only have to go back to the fall of 1963, less than a year, to find people singing a very different tune.
We are at the critical stage of a somber and inexorable cycle that seems to have gripped the public affairs of the nation. We are mired in governmental deadlock.
This is verbatim from The Deadlock of Democracy, a 1963 book written by James McGregor Burns, a prominent political scientist at the time.
As Congress blocks or kills not only most of Mr. Kennedy's bold proposals, but many planks of the Republican platform as well, we still underestimate the extent to which our system was designed for deadlock and inaction.
Civil rights leaders were among those not holding their breath for congressional action. Historian David Blight says that when Martin Luther King Jr. met with President Kennedy in 1961, King's focus wasn't on a bill ending segregation, but on an executive order, one that would echo an executive order of exactly 100 years earlier.
Every chance he got in 1961, 62, and into 63, he appealed to the Kennedy White House to issue a second Emancipation Proclamation.
Why did King and SCLC and movement leaders put their faith initially in executive orders? It's because in those years, they didn't believe any kind of legislation about segregation would ever come out of the Congress because of the control the Southern Democrats had on most congressional committees. They thought if they were ever going to get anywhere at the national level, it would be with executive power.
Kennedy never delivered the proclamation that King was looking for, but he did issue an executive order banning discrimination in federally supported housing. And in the summer of 63, Kennedy threw the ball back to Congress with a bill that would ban segregation in public accommodations. 8 days before he was assassinated, President Kennedy was asked in a news conference about the lack of action on that bill. It was clear to many that it was not going anywhere.
Does that disturb you?
Oh, I think that the longer they're delayed, I think it is unfortunate. The fact of the matter.
Remarkably, less than 8 months later, that bill had become law.
The conventional story of the Civil Rights Act goes something like this. A Congress in mourning for Kennedy rallies around his landmark legislation to cement his legacy, guided along by relentless LBJ, otherwise known as the Master of the Senate. But if you look a little harder, you can see that the true story was a lot more complicated, and that the Civil Rights Act was, in fact, the culmination of a wide range of factors that came together in the summer of 1964.
And so today on the show, we're going to unravel this knot of historical forces and trace some of the moment's key strands back in time. But first, it's worth considering just what the Civil Rights Act of 1964 mandated. At its core, the act outlawed discrimination based on race, color, religion, or national origin in public accommodations. This applied to private businesses that served the public, such as motels and restaurants. It also explicitly prohibited state or local governments from denying access to government facilities, such as hospitals, parks, or swimming pools. The act also prohibited discrimination by employers on the basis of race, color, religion, national origin, or sex. That sums up the key features of a landmark act that dismantled Jim Crow segregation. But guys, how did that system of segregation start in the first place?
Yeah, Ed, don't be modest. You read a whole book about this.
Yeah, I have to admit I did, but let's boil it down backstory style. Segregation, the process of keeping black people and white people separate in public places. Now, that begins in some ways right after slavery. Cemeteries, for example, are segregated. And then you start seeing it in restaurants and hotels.
Churches places. Must have been segregated, weren't they?
Ed? Oh, no, to the contrary.
Really?
Churches were remarkably integrated before the Civil War.
That's fascinating.
What happens almost with the end of slavery is African-American church members say, hey, fellow white parishioners, you understand why we might want our own church? And white people say, yeah, we actually do. And there's a lot of times when the white churches give their black congregants money or a space to create churches. So the first things that segregate are the churches, Brian, but it's completely voluntary.
Yeah.
One of the first things that black people want to do is get away from white people who
they've
been far too, you know, vulnerable, especially in households. So you'll see black families removing female members from white households if they possibly can. Mm. So as soon as slavery ends, there's a kind of a settling out of black people and white people, but you don't have statewide segregation laws for 25 years after emancipation.
All right, so why is that, Ed? What's the pressure for segregation, for making it the law of the state?
Well, let me ask you this question, Peter. What would you segregate if you were a state-level lawmaker in the South in the 1870s and 1880s?
I know.
Yeah.
Transportation.
There you go.
And by transportation, we really mean railroads.
Yeah, railroads.
Well, now let's think about this. So there's transportation in the 1860s and 1870s. Why does it take them 25 years to segregate it, Brian?
I don't know. That's what we pay you the big bucks for.
We need to remember the railroads are booming in the South at this time. The South is being interlaced with railroads at a remarkably rapid pace. And by 1890, 90% of all Southern counties have a railroad passing through them. Okay? And that is a huge increase from just 15 or 20 years earlier. So here's the story. All these railroads back then are divided into two classes, first class and second class. Second-class cars are the ones up closer to the locomotive, and basically they're cheaper, and you don't want to be on those cars.
Smelly. They're dirtier, right?
Well, people are spitting tobacco juice all over the floor, for example. People are drinking out of bottles, and it's black and white together. The other car, first-class car, is more commonly called the parlor car. It would have velour upholstery. It would have carpeting, maybe restroom facilities. And it would, as much as possible, simulate the intimacy of a parlor.
And did black and white people use that parlor car?
Any black people who could afford it did, right? Here is something that people have a hard time imagining. In the 25 years after the Civil War, a lot of people formerly held in slavery were actually able to build what we would consider by the standards of the day middle-class lives. Mm-hmm. Widespread growth in literacy among the African-American population, pretty widespread growth in property holding, amazingly enough. And certainly, Brian, you asked about these churches. These churches generate a large number of people who consider themselves genteel and refined, and who the last place they want to be is in a car with promiscuous cursing, blasphemy, drinking, right? And so they want to go to these parlor cars. And so that congregation getting on a car in one community, people go, yeah, well, those are the good people, the good Christians who, you know, they work for us. I trust them. They come to the next station, and some white guy gets on and go, who are these people with the effrontery to be in a parlor car that maybe I can't afford, or that I can't afford to put my daughter on, or more importantly, that I can't afford to put my daughter on? And what are they doing violating these class boundaries by being respectable and genteel?
So what you're saying, Ed, is that local custom does segregate in that period before Jim Crow, but it also allows crossing and transgression and intimacy and recognition.
It requires those things, Peter.
Yeah.
Right? The white people don't want to really be segregated from black people in their households.
That's right.
Who's going to take care of your children? And so the white South wants to have it both ways. They want to be separated from black strangers and be able to be close to black people they know. And so what you find is that the railroads will sometimes, at the insistence of a white passenger, throw a black passenger off the train or force especially a young woman onto a second-class car. And they get sued by the black families who say, we paid for a first-class ticket. You did not deliver first-class service. And the railroads lose over and over again.
Yeah.
And so the railroads say, they're caught. They don't want to be policing these ambiguous race relations, right. Peter.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, they don't want to be sued. On the other hand, they don't want to have to run separate cars for black people.
Right.
So you can see where this is going. You've heard the phrase separate but equal.
Yeah.
What they say is put a partition in the second class car and put African American people who are paying first class fares behind that partition in the second class car out of the parlor car, and we'll call that equal. And then Plessy versus Ferguson, 1896, says, yes, that's okay. You can be separate as long as it's equal. And of course, the charade is it's never equal. So you have in 10 years this kind of revolution on the railroads in which the state becomes an agent of separating out people by race and class and gender.
And Ed, how does this spread to things that are very local, from water fountains to schools to hospitals?
Yeah, where would you find a water fountain in the South in the 1890s, Brian?
Maybe in the train station.
In the train station, right, yeah. Is that the train stations are the most modern places there are. And here's the great paradox. The newer a place was, the more likely it was to be segregated.
And do they associate these ideas with modernity itself? Do they view this as what we would call progressive?
Yes.
Yeah.
Because who's doing this? It's young state lawmakers who are saying, we can't have this chaos all the time. We can't have this pushing and pulling and threats of violence and just bad feelings between the races. So here's a plan. Let's segregate the races legally so everybody knows where they're supposed to be all the time. And there won't be this question about who deserves first-class treatment and who doesn't. You need to legislate social order and control through law in every facet of life. So by the time Brian and I grow up in the South in the 1950s, you'd have segregated Bibles in the courthouses. You'd have the school books for children separated in the summers in warehouses. Once this contagion of rationalizing relationships between blacks and whites as law begins, it's like a cancer that spreads. That's why the Civil Rights Act is so important. It has to overturn all of these things that begin with a railroad car and end up extending into every facet of life.
I'm Peter Onuf.
I'm Brian Ballow.
And I'm Ed Ayers. We're marking the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 with a look at the various strands that came together to make its passage possible. One of the strands had as much to do with what was happening outside the country as it did with what was happening here at home. In the few years leading up to 1964, some 30 African nations had achieved their independence, and these new countries were quick to send official delegations to embassies in the United States. Now, usually, these representatives flew into New York City, maybe stopped at the United Nations, then drove south to Washington to present their credentials to President Kennedy and Secretary of State Dean Rusk.
And at that time, Route 40 was the main thoroughfare, the main highway employed by them.
This is Burl Bernhard, acting director of the United States Commission on Civil Rights in the early 60s. He points out that Maryland was a few hours into the drive to Washington, and so a natural stopping point.
And a number of the African diplomats would seek to stay at a hotel or a motel, seek to have dinner at one of the restaurants along the route. And they were told, I'm sorry, we don't have your kind here.
When the diplomats arrived in the nation's capital, their greeting wasn't much better. Housing in Washington was largely segregated, and many dignitaries struggled to find homes in the neighborhoods that were anywhere close to their embassies.
The embarrassment and the anger that was growing out of what was happening on Route 40 got to the attention, and did get the attention, of both President Kennedy and Dean Rusk.
Now, here's why this mattered so much to the State Department. These very same diplomats from Africa were representing countries very much at play in the Cold War. JFK was eager to bring these non-aligned nations into America's camp. But these accounts of a two-tiered society were grist for the Soviet propaganda mill. Route 40 was becoming a PR nightmare for the Kennedy administration. And in 1961, Bernhard received a letter from the president.
It was a short letter, and he said, "I would very much appreciate it if you would use the resources of your office and your own knowledge of these issues to see what could be done along Route 40, and I hope that you could convene some of the people who seem most offended." And in this case, he was talking about the whites who were most offended by being preyed upon by these outside forces.
In the fall of 1961, Bernhard and officials from the State and Justice Departments held a meeting with these white business owners in Aberdeen, Maryland.
I started it saying that the president was asking for your cooperation because it was an overriding issue for the United States, and we were being sorely embarrassed that this issue is no longer just an issue of appropriate morality internally within this country and the domestic side. It is also undermining the respect for our nation. And I know that all of you believe deeply in the values of America.
His audience wasn't impressed, a fact that became very clear as soon as the floor was open to comments.
I remember the first one because he was very close to me, and he said, "What the hell are you doing here?" And I thought that opened it up pretty well.
The meeting devolved pretty quickly. Lots of yelling, lots of booing. These business proprietors had no intention of desegregating, and they resented what they saw as government interference in their private affairs. Bernhard says he was left with no choice but to deliver a kind of ultimatum.
If this continues, there is going to be a need for us to find alternative ways to show the respect that foreign dignitaries are entitled to when they're driving to present their credentials to the President of the United States and the Secretary of State.
Fast forward to the summer of 1963. In the face of continued resistance at the local and state levels, the administration made good on its threat. Secretary of State Rusk himself testified on Capitol Hill in support of Kennedy's new civil rights bill, citing the second-class treatment that foreign dignitaries had been receiving. Bernhard says that many white Americans got the message.
There were many people, and I can tell you I heard it, that would say, "You know, I don't really like all these protests. I don't like these unrests and the disquietude. But, you know, I really hate the idea that these damn Soviets are using it, and we're being hurt both from a national security standpoint, from an economic standpoint, from a feeling that we were not a really nice country." They could relate to that, and it came up again and again during the legislative fight to get the public accommodations law passed.
Burl Bernhard is the former staff director of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights.
The Civil Rights Act of 1964 is celebrated for effectively eliminating racial segregation in the South. It prohibited state and local governments from denying access to people on the basis of race, and it forbade discrimination by employers. But people knew as early as 1963 that the bill would fail to address one key issue. The summer before the bill passed, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee Chair John Lewis gave a passionate speech at the March on Washington, calling for the inclusion of Title III. That title would have mandated federal protection for African Americans who faced violence throughout the South.
"Unless Title III is put in this bill, there's nothing to protect the young children and old women who must face police dogs and fire hoses in the South while they engage in peaceful demonstration."
The first place I ever worked in Mississippi was a little bitty town in Sunflower County called Ruleville. It had about 1,100 people.
This is Charles Cobb Jr., a former field secretary for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee who worked to register voters in the summer of 1964.
The three of us who had come up there hadn't been there more than 2 days before, while walking down a dirt road, a car pulls up beside us. Out jumps a white guy. He's got a pistol, and he's waving it at us and telling us, "I know you all ain't from here, and you're here to cause trouble. I'm here to tell you to get out of town."
Wow.
So then he orders us into his car, and one of the people I was with, a guy named Charles McLaurin, asked him, "Well, why do we have to get in the car?" And he says, "'Cause this pistol says so." You know, he's still holding this pistol at. Well, this guy turns out to be the mayor of the town, who also does police patrols. He owns the biggest business in town, which is the hardware store. He was president of the White Citizens Council. And when we get to City Hall, where he takes us, it also turns out he's the justice of the peace.
When I sat down with Cobb, he pointed out that the violence against African Americans in the Deep South was not limited to the civil rights activists coming from other places. Much of it was directed towards the African Americans who had lived there for generations.
The movement in Mississippi, and I would argue throughout the South, was led by Southerners, specifically black Southerners, maids and sharecroppers and small farmers and barbers and, you know, ordinary folk. And local people in these communities needed protection from the violence that inevitably followed any attempt at civil rights, any attempt at voter registration. The state was murderously violent, and that violence was, one, encouraged by state and local officials, and two, ignored by the federal government. And our largest concern was gaining some kind of protection, federal marshals. And we felt it had to come from the federal level.
Sure. So when the bill actually passed, what was in it that might protect you?
Nothing.
Nothing.
No,
zero. So you got nothing on that security front, which was
the most important
thing to you.
Yeah. That doesn't begin to change until the following year with the passage of the Voting Rights Act.
Why didn't the civil rights bill address that need for protection, not just of organizers, but of African Americans throughout the South?
Well, you run into something, and that is that the president in particular had to reach a practical accommodation with the people who ruled the white South. And the argument that the political people in the South were making was an argument that you hear today, and that is the federal government is interfering with their way of life. The phrase, the word they used was interposition. And presidents, political people were very sensitive to that. And you run into, when you start talking about federal protection, trumping county sheriffs or local police departments, you run into that argument.
We both know that starting about the time of the Civil Rights Act of 64 and the Voting Rights Act of 65, the United States became a racially more turbulent place, with riots breaking out in many major cities for the rest of the decade. Do you think that if the Civil Rights Act of 64 had addressed this question of physical protection for African Americans more adequately, this could have been avoided?
Well, neither the 1964 Civil Rights Act, which was primarily concerned with access to public accommodation, nor the 1965 Voting Rights Act, which was primarily concerned with protecting the right to vote, addressed the larger questions of economic insecurity, of alienation, which are national. Remember, the Civil Rights Acts target the South. It's not legislation that makes any attempt to address these huge issues. So in that sense, I tend to resist, you know, trying to connect the inadequacies of those two acts with the turmoil, if you will, that accompanies the unaddressed issues in the country.
Thank you for joining us on Backstory, Mr. Cobb.
Thank you.
Charles Cobb Jr. is a former field secretary for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and a visiting professor at Brown University. His brand new book is called This Nonviolent Stuff Will Get You Killed: How Guns Made the Civil Rights Movement Possible. If you're just joining us, this is Backstory. And we're talking today about the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the momentous piece of federal legislation that turns 50 this week. We're going to home in now on one section of that act, Title VII, which deals with employment discrimination. It was written to prohibit discrimination on the basis of race, color, religion, and national origin. But one group of activists felt like something very important was missing.
You have to realize that at that particular point in time, we had practically reached the point of saying that discrimination on the basis of race was bad. We had not reached the point of saying that discrimination on the basis of sex was bad.
This is Joe Freeman, who's written about how women came to be included in Title VII of the Civil Rights Act.
The general attitude at that time was that women were sufficiently different from men that it was okay to treat them differently in the workplace. The only question was how differently and under what circumstances.
Many states did treat women differently. They subjected women to so-called protective laws, which restricted when, where, and even how they could work, which is part of the reason why, ever since 1923, an organization called the National Woman's Party had been lobbying for a constitutional amendment that would make women the legal equals of men. When President Kennedy proposed his civil rights bill in 1963, the National Woman's Party recognized the opportunity. They asked the House Rules Committee chairman, a Virginia congressman named Howard Smith, to introduce an amendment adding sex to the categories of discrimination that would be prohibited. They knew that he would bring a lot of Southern votes with him.
Now, keep in mind, Howard W. Smith was not in favor of the Civil Rights Bill. He was a good old boy from Virginia, and he would love to have kept the Civil Rights Bill bottled up in the Rules Committee and never gotten out, but he couldn't do that.
Freeman believes that by this point, Southern Democrats in Congress could see the writing on the wall. They knew they were going to lose the battle over the Civil Rights Bill, and Smith determined that he would get something that he wanted out of it. He worried that if Title VII protected all black people, white women were going to be left at the back of the hiring line. And so, on February 8, 1964, Smith took to the House floor to call for the addition of the word sex to the text of the law.
Emanuel Seller, who opposed the idea, then got up and made a joke about it. And that sort of set the tone for the subsequent debate. It became very jocular. And it created the myth that sex had been added to Title VII as a joke, that it wasn't really serious.
It was a myth, says Freeman, buoyed by the fact that the main backer of the idea was dead set against integration.
Unfortunately, the fact that it was a Southerner who introduced it, and everyone knew that he was opposed to the Civil Rights Bill, tainted the addition of sex. It made it look like it was a Southern ploy against the bill rather than really an independent effort to get what Howard W. Smith said was a little bit of good out of this iniquitous bill.
The version of the Civil Rights Act that ultimately became law did include the sex provision. And almost immediately, women started invoking it. Complaints about sex discrimination in the workplace soon made up about one-third of the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission's workload. The myth, however, had taken its toll.
Part of what came with that myth was the idea that the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission therefore did not have to take the sex provision seriously, that it could essentially ignore it. Indeed, its first executive director called it a fluke, which was conceived out of wedlock.
Women saw that their complaints were being ignored. And that's when the idea began circulating that women needed their own version of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, the NAACP.
And the consequence of that was in 1966, 2 years after the Sex Amendment was added, the National Organization for Women was formed. And indeed, its initial demand was that the EEOC enforce the law.
That group, the National Organization for Women, or NOW, became a major player in the women's movement of the 1960s and 70s. So, in effect, adding the word sex to Title VII helped bring change that had been a long time coming. Thanks to Jo Freeman for her help in telling that story. Her most recent book is We Will Be Heard, Women's Struggles for Political Power in the United States.
It's time for a short break. When we get back, how the failure of the Brown v. Board decision set the stage for the success of the Civil Rights Act a decade later.
This is Backstory. I'm Peter Onuf.
I'm Brian Ballow.
And I'm Ed Ayers. Today on the show, the backstory of the bill that ended legal segregation in the South, the 1964 Civil Rights Act. We'll turn now to the actual passage of the law. And it wasn't easy. When the bill finally made its way out of the House of Representatives in 1964, it moved to a Senate that was divided in four different groups. Two segments championed the bill, liberal Democrats and liberal Republicans. They accounted together for a little less than half of the Senate. On the other hand, roughly 20 Southern Democrats were determined to prolong debate for so long that the bill would never see the light of the day. A legislative maneuver we know as the filibuster. From February until June, they managed to hold off a vote, making it the longest collective filibuster in Senate history. At the time, you needed 67 votes to break a filibuster to reach what's known as cloture. This meant that an unlikely cluster of senators held the key to passage, conservative Republicans in the West and Midwest. They weren't segregationists, but they did not like big government, as they saw it, intruding into states' business. For months, Senate leaders negotiated with these Republicans in an effort to gain their support for the bill. On June 9th, the night before the cloture vote, President Johnson got on the phone with the senator in charge of pushing the law through, Hubert Humphrey of Minnesota, to confirm that they had the votes. Here's the story of those final hours.
Senator Humphrey on 9-1.
Tell me, do you have a reliable count on your cloture?
I'm counting, we got some Republicans that come in that sound pretty good.
Counted Yarbrough?
Yarbrough, count him, yes.
Our information is that they weren't quite that sure.
Well, I'll put the arm on him again. He told me he was going to go.
Yarbrough told you?
Yep.
Today?
Yep.
My name is Clay Risen. I'm the author of The Bill of the Century, The Epic Battle for the Civil Rights Act.
I'm Don Ritchie, and I'm the Senate historian. The night before the cloture vote was taken, they still didn't know they had enough votes. You know, Humphrey, as the Democratic leader on this bill,
he barely got 3 hours of sleep that night, and he was constantly on the phone calling up senators saying, can I get your vote? Can I get your vote? Where do you really stand on this? And if you're still shaky, what do you need to hear? And that was going on really until the morning of the vote.
And I haven't got any commitment out of Edmondson yet. But the boys tell me that it looks good. I've asked some of the people to contact his brother. I've been after Edmondson 2 or 3 times.
There were a lot of concerns. This was going to expand the power of the federal government. It was going to influence what, you know, motel owners and restaurant owners could do, the mom-and-pop stores, it was an expansion of federal powers in a way that really troubled a lot of conservatives in particular.
And those people held the balance of votes. If you could win over enough of them, then you would have 67 votes. And even when they walked into the chamber, they didn't know whether they had any votes to spare.
Before they took that vote, however, Everett Dirksen gave one of the great speeches of his career.
So Everett Dirksen was a conservative Republican in charge of the Republican caucus in the Senate.
He stood up and reminded the senators that his party had a long history of supporting civil rights. And he went back and told the sort of history from Lincoln up to the present of Republicans supporting civil rights. And then he quoted Victor Hugo as saying that stronger than all of the armies are an idea whose time has come. It really resonated with the Senate. It gave a lot of confidence and also some cover for a lot of senators who were on the edge on this issue. They also had one senator, Claire Engel of California,
who had a brain tumor and was wheeled into the Senate to give his vote.
He couldn't speak at this stage, and he was bedridden. And they so desperately needed votes that they persuaded his family to get him up and get him dressed and bring him in a wheelchair into the chamber.
And the Senate clerk called his name, and he very, very slowly and haltingly raised his left finger up to his eye and pointed at it.
And the clerk accepted that as an aye or a yes vote. It was very dramatic. It had a big impact on the other senators as well that he was there. But it was that close. In fact, it wasn't until the last Republican, John Williams, voted aye that there was this great sigh of relief that they knew that they had the votes.
Yes? The Attorney General asking for you on 9-0.
All right. Hello?
Well, Mr. President.
Hi, Bobby.
How are you?
Fine. You think cloture is decided now, don't you?
It looks that way. It'd be just a miracle getting this bill. I mean, who could have thought a year ago that we'd get this bill?
That was Senate historian Donald Ritchie and the New York Times' Clay Risen. Risen's book is called The Bill of the Century, The Epic Battle for the Civil Rights Act. We're used to thinking of the 1964 Civil Rights Act as the Civil Rights Act, but in fact, it wasn't the first one. During Reconstruction after the Civil War, Congress passed several Civil Rights Acts, including one in 1875 banning segregation in public accommodations, essentially private businesses that were open to the public. If that sounds similar to the 1964 Act, that's because it was. You see, in 1883, the Supreme Court struck down that earlier Civil Rights Act. The court said that the 14th Amendment's guarantee of equal protection applied only where government action was concerned, not action by private citizens or businesses. This became known as the State Action Doctrine. The court also found ways to justify state-mandated segregation, ruling, for instance, in the famous Plessy v. Ferguson case, that separate facilities were acceptable as long as they were supposedly equal. And the court interpreted voting rights provisions as narrowly as possible, helping Southern states to eviscerate the political power that some black men had wielded since Reconstruction. But in the 20th century, the Supreme Court reversed course. Backstory producer Emily Charnock has a story of how the court became an ally of civil rights activists and in 1964 wound up helping the Civil Rights Act become law.
There's an irony in the Supreme Court's role in the civil rights movement. In the 19th century, the court had done a lot to deny African Americans their civil and political rights. But if many black people couldn't vote, they could still file a lawsuit. And so in the early 20th century, groups like the NAACP turned to the very same court to help restore those rights. They launched a litigation campaign, taking on employment discrimination, disparities in the criminal justice system, and segregated housing, bringing narrow test cases and trying, little by little, to move the Supreme Court their way. And in the 1930s and 40s, it seemed to be working.
The Supreme Court's not doing a whole lot, but it is at the edges starting to intervene into this system of segregation and injustice that exists in the South.
This is Risa Golubov, a law professor at the University of Virginia. She says that the NAACP launched a new phase of this campaign in the early 1950s when they challenged segregation in the public school system. The NAACP lawyers argued that separate could never be equal, And in 1954, the Supreme Court, led by Chief Justice Earl Warren, agreed. In Brown versus Board of Education, they overturned Plessy versus Ferguson and struck down segregation, at least in the public schools. The Brown decision was a watershed moment, but its practical impact was limited. The justices didn't say how school systems should go about desegregating or how fast.
And there is some desegregation that happens after Brown, especially in the border states. There's a little bit of minimal kind of token desegregation. But in the Deep South, there is virtually no desegregation after Brown.
By 1964, only 2% of blacks were attending white schools in the Deep South. The court simply couldn't enforce its judgments alone.
The courts are known as the least dangerous branch. They do not have the power of the purse. They do not have the power of the sword. Unless they have federal executive or legislative power behind them, it's very hard for them to implement change on their own.
So civil rights activists increasingly looked for ways to inspire change through direct action. In the early 1960s, they began a wave of sit-ins across the American South, protesting segregation beyond the schools, in places like restaurants, movie theaters, and swimming pools.
And as a result of all these protests, what happens when people sit down at a lunch counter that doesn't want them? They get arrested. And so there are thousands and thousands of cases going through the southern state courts, many of which make their way up to the Supreme Court. And so starting in the early 1960s, the Supreme Court is trying to figure out how it's going to respond to all these convictions.
The court had said back in 1883 that the protections of the 14th Amendment only applied where there was state action and that the state wasn't involved when private business owners decided to turn away blacks. But the sit-in cases were complicating that clean division. It was exactly this at issue in Bell versus Maryland, which came before the court in October 1963. The facts of the case were pretty typical, says Yale Law professor Bruce Ackerman.
There was a sit-in in a restaurant in Baltimore, Maryland, and the owner of the restaurant said, "Get out. This is private property, man. Get out."
Robert Bell and 11 other African-American students refused to leave, so the owner called the police, who arrested them on grounds of criminal trespass on private property.
This obviously raises the state action question that was at issue in 1883. If a private business wants you to leave their business, they should be able to do that. Well, the problem is when they call the police and ask for help from the state to eject you from their private business, have they now used state action in such a way that the 14th Amendment protections will kick in and that they might have violated the 14th Amendment?
The students thought that it did, asking the court to revisit its 1883 decision in the civil rights cases, just as the Brown decision had revisited and overruled Plessy versus Ferguson. At this very moment, Congress was beginning to consider meaningful civil rights legislation, finally responding to the wave of protests that was gripping the nation. A huge part of the bill was about banning segregation in public accommodations, meaning the civil rights cases were center stage here too. This was the situation as the Supreme Court gathered in the late spring of 1964 to consider its decision in Bell versus Maryland. And at first, it looked like the court was going to rule against the protesters. Hugo Black, an associate justice from the Deep South, simply refused to see state action in their arrests, and he had a 5-4 majority willing to go along with him. But one of the dissenting justices, William Brennan, feared that Black's opinion would send the wrong message at the wrong time.
Brennan, who is the sort of liberal statesman on the court, says, "Oh my God, what's going to happen if the Supreme Court, by a vote of 5-4, reaffirms the constitutional restrictions imposed by this old civil rights case of 1883, are we going to really say that the Civil Rights Act that Johnson finally is going to be is pushing is unconstitutional? Oh my God."
So Brennan played for time and tried to persuade the conservative majority to back down from issuing a strong opinion. Black wasn't budging, but another justice, Tom Clark, proved more receptive. In late May, he switched sides, and with the fervor of a convert, he got to work on a strong opinion, overturning the civil rights case's precedent altogether, an opinion that would offer a much more expansive understanding of how far equal protection applied.
He writes an opinion which says, if In the normal course of life, people expect to be served in restaurants and things like that. If that's a foundational element in what it is to live an ordinary life, then these restaurants cannot discriminate against blacks.
But Brennan saw danger here, too. By this point, in early June, the Civil Rights Bill was finally moving forward in the Senate after a months-long filibuster was defeated. Now Brennan feared that a big decision from the court, even one that seemed to favor civil rights, might actually derail the legislation.
Oh my God, says Brennan. If we come down, if Clark comes down with his 5-4 decision overruling the state action doctrine, what's going to happen? Various people in the Congress are going to take that as an excuse to say, let's not pass this provision of the Civil Rights Act, or maybe the whole Civil Rights Act. The Supreme Court has done our work for us. Let's forget about it.
And if the Congress didn't act, Brennan feared that a favorable court decision would have little impact on the ground and might even backfire.
They were afraid of what it would do to their legitimacy if they sat up there and kept saying, this is wrong and that is wrong and this is wrong, and no one did anything. Who's going to listen to them? All they have is their power of persuasion.
So Brennan got to work on a new maneuver, ultimately persuading his fellow justices to decide the case on narrow, technical grounds, overturning the convictions of the sit-in protesters and returning their cases to the Maryland courts.
You know, so suddenly Brennan, after making all these profound objections for months and months and months, defects from Clark, gets a majority with Potter Stewart, and writes this extremely wimpy opinion.
That wimpy opinion, Ackerman says, helped ensure the civil rights legislation stayed on track. Just 10 days after the court ruled in Bell versus Maryland, the Civil Rights Act was signed into law by President Johnson. By effectively taking the court out of the action, Brennan had helped to ensure the Civil Rights Bill became law. All of this makes Brennan seem like a master politician, a role we might have some qualms about a Supreme Court justice playing. But Golubov says the justices often take the broader political context into account.
You know, you see it in the New Deal era. You see it in the Reconstruction era. There's a conversation that's going back and forth between the different branches. Sometimes it's more positive. Sometimes it's full of conflict. And I think the justices are thinking about politics quite a lot.
Bill Brennan sees the reality that the American people finally and amazingly, and it wasn't inevitable, had made up their mind. And it would be infinitely superior to have the politicians take responsibility for this than 9 old men, especially when 5 of them aren't so sure.
While politicians did finally take responsibility on civil rights in 1964, Ackerman says we should be careful not to give them too much credit. The impetus came from the actions and the perseverance of the civil rights movement throughout the 1950s and 60s. And though the Supreme Court might have given some encouragement to that movement with Brown versus Board of Education and helped move the Civil Rights Act along with their decision in Bell versus Maryland, it was the actions of those on the ground that really counted.
We don't have an Earl Warren Day. We do have a Martin Luther King Day. Why? Because he inspired the nation. Not the Warren Court or this little story, fascinating though it may be, of Bell against Maryland.
That's Bruce Ackerman from Yale University. We also heard from the University of Virginia's Risa Golubov. Emily Charnock, who narrated that piece, is one of our producers.
That's going to do it for us today, but we're eager to hear your thoughts. Our website is backstoryradio.org. You can find more information on all of today's guests there and subscribe to our weekly podcast. Don't be a stranger.
Today's episode of Backstory was produced by Tony Field, Nina Ernest, Andrew Parsons, Emily Charnock, and Kelly Jones, with help from Sam Ulbschneider. Special thanks this week to Tom Jackson, Kevin McFadden, Hassan Jeffries, and James Scales. Backstory's executive producer is Andrew Windham. Turn me around, turn me around, turn me around. Ain't gonna let nobody turn me around. I just keep on walking, keep on talking, marching on a freedom land.
Major support for Backstory is provided by an anonymous donor, the University of Virginia, the National Endowment for the Humanities, and the Joseph and Robert Cornell Memorial Foundation. Additional funding is provided by Weinstein Properties, by the Tomato Fund, cultivating fresh ideas in the arts, the humanities, and the environment, and by History Channel, history made every day.
Brian Ballow is professor of history at the University of Virginia. Peter Onuf is professor of history emeritus at UVA and senior research fellow at Monticello. Ed Ayers is president and professor of history at the University of Richmond. Backstory was created by Andrew Windham for the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities.